Hello, this is Scott Wells for the Magic Word Podcast, and today I am very pleased to have with me as my guest Mr. Mark Holstein. Hi there, Mark.
Hey, Scott. How are you doing?
I'm doing great, thank you. And I wanted to talk with you today about your good friend Marshall Brodeen.
Absolutely.
I know that you have been a longtime associate and friend of his, and you having lived back in the Chicago area. And so I wanted just to touch base with you about this because Marshall is really not physically as and mentally alert as what he once was, but I think it's important that we kind of have some information that's going to be laid out somewhere in podcast land that people can go back and listen to some archives about his wonderful life.
Great. Well, I'm obviously happy to do that and to do that for my friend Marshall.
Well, and let's go back then, I guess, a little bit, kind of how that you got started in magic, which I think was kind of inspired by Marshall, ironically.
Well, No, it sure was. You're absolutely right. And like a lot of magicians of my age, we became aware of magic through the TV magic cards and TV magic sets commercials. And I saw Marshall's commercials, which ran heavily in the Chicago area, but lots of other places too. And one Christmas asked for a Marshall Brodeen magic set, and I got it from my godmother, actually. And that's where it started. I came to learn later his second set, and the first one that he really marketed heavily on television.
And did that have like what little cups and balls and things in it, or what little plastic?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. As I recall, you're right. There was a set of cups and balls. I recall the rice bowls trick. I recall the ring on the spring. I think there was probably a color vision. I think there was a coin box type of trick, and there may have been, if I'm remembering it correctly, a small drawer box or something like that.
I know that you collect a lot of stuff and keep a lot of things like most magicians do. Do you possibly still have that kit?
I wish I did. No, I don't. Unfortunately, I think I wore it all out learning the tricks and doing them at the time. So I don't have the set. But, you know, I did what almost every magician does when they go to Marshall's home, where he's got every magic set he ever produced on display on a wall, mm-hmm. and went right to the wall and said, "That's the one."
So it's there. You don't have it in your collection, but it's in his.
It's in his. That's right. Yeah. That's right. In fact, as far as I know, there are only two complete collections. I'm sure there are others that I don't know about, but there are only two complete collections of Marshall sets. One is Marshall's, and the other is Marshall sent one of every set, or sometimes several of every set, that he produced to Bob Lund. So the American Museum of Magic has a complete collection.
Wow. I know that, yeah, Bob Lund's collection, or the American Museum of Magic, has, yeah, just about everything, and they just keep expanding all the time then, too, certainly. With the magic kit that you had back then, and, you know, I always think of cups and balls as being something that's a little bit more advanced and not something that really is, well, age-appropriate for an 8-year-old. You know, it seems like that they can get discouraged pretty quickly with trying to learn the cups and balls. Did you have any problem with that, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, it's a good question because, of course, you're right that cups and balls can be a very complex illusion to perform. But Marshall was really important to him that the magic he put in his sets was done in a way that the kids would be successful. He worried a lot about giving them tricks that they couldn't perform or wouldn't be able to perform well, and then they would get frustrated. Mm-hmm. And so one of the things he did was, for something like the cups and balls, he included a very simple kind of rudimentary routine that a young kid could do. Didn't involve a lot of sleight of hand, and it was a lot of, you know, the ball hidden under one of the cups and, you know, stacking them up and then having it go through the cups is sort of one of the very first things any of us learn with the cups and balls.
Right.
And so he made sure there was a routine included that a young guy could do.
Seems like I recall the commercials you were referring to there also of him demonstrating that. So I guess he was trying to show that it is fairly easy.
That's right. And so it's interesting because, of course, that was his tagline, "Magic is easy once you know the secret," which, of course, on one level is frustrating to magicians because we all know it's not easy. And Marshall knows it's not easy. But the magic that he included was intended to be performable. And the demonstration of the cups and balls he did wasn't sort of the kind of thing we'd see at a lecture with complex moves. He did the actual routine the way he would teach it in the instructions.
And as I recall, the cups, of course, are a lot smaller, so they'd fit the hands of a smaller child.
Yeah, absolutely. They were, that's right, and they were also very colorful. They were, the quality of the plastic and the props in these sets was actually quite high for the day, and so they were designed, the sets were designed so that they wouldn't break, you know, the first or second time that the child would play with it. They were really designed to last.
Yeah, I know you said he has a whole wall of these. I know that he has other people's kits he's put together for Lance Burton and Siegfried and Roy and others.
Right, right. And he did a substantial number of sets for Disney, including when the Aladdin movie came out. He did a whole line of sets with, you know, obviously tying to the magic theme in Aladdin. But you're right, he did some absolutely beautiful sets for Siegfried and Roy, both in terms of the content and also the cover art is really stunning. And then he did some beautiful sets for Lance. Lance only sold Marshall's products, magic sets, in his shop at the Monte Carlo. And those were also beautifully done, and of course, color themed to Lance's purple and black color theme. So very striking magic sets.
You know, nowadays it seems that anybody can have their name and picture or whatever on a magic kit, available through India and China and other places where they're fairly cheap, cheaply made. And his seemed like that they were always a little bit higher quality or better made kits.
Yeah, that was important to Marshall. One, because he cared about the quality of the product associated with his name, but he also, I think, had in mind that, you know, people wouldn't buy one set; they would buy a set for their child, and then maybe they'd have another child, or a cousin, or a neighbor, or whatever. And so he really was interested in creating a reputation and regular customers.
Yeah. And after a while, I guess he kind of moved away from the magic kits. And, well, that's always been kind of the basics of it. But I know he had the TV magic cards and everything. But I'm really kind of getting ahead of myself a little bit. I wanted to go back to, again, when you had the magic kit. And then how did you actually make that connection as far as ever getting to meet him for the first time?
Yeah, it was probably over the course of several years. I can't remember for sure, but I think I must have met Marshall for the first time at Magic Inc., which was Jay and Fran Marshall's magic shop in Chicago, and really the headquarters for magic in Chicago in every way, socially and otherwise. It was the place we all hung out. Mm-hmm. And, you know, Saturday afternoons, people would just hang around the magic shop, and there was a core group of what were at the time, to me, old-timers. I recognize now Marshall wasn't actually that old at the time, but it seemed like it when you're 12 or 13 years old. And there were a group of them that were always very approachable and friendly to young magicians. And I remember Marshall was always one of them. Diop Louie was another one. George Johnstone was another one. And they would make guys like me feel important and special. And I learned later from Marshall that, you know, when he started in magic, he would go to magic clubs or go to the magic shop, and the professionals would be a bit standoffish, and he was always intimidated by that. And he thought, as he became successful in magic, that just was wrong. And so he would go out of his way to be approachable. So I'm sure I met him in that context. Then the first time I had the opportunity to perform on the Bozo Show, which we haven't talked about yet, he was not on camera that day, but happened to be in the studio. And when he saw me come in with magic props, he immediately came over, said hello, and we had a really nice conversation. And then just over the years, we would run into each other at magic events and conventions and the like, and then ultimately became friends and then very close friends.
Well, I know that Marshall, of course, just for those who are listening that may not know, I guess, his credentials and what all that he has done, there is an excellent book that John Mooring has put together. Title of that escapes me for just a second.
It's The Magical Life of Marshall Brodeen, and it is an excellent, it really is an amazing book, just because it would be a shorter list to list the things Marshall hasn't done in magic. He really has done everything. And John, of course, is a wonderful writer, as most people listening to this would know. And he did a great job of pulling the stories out of Marshall and then organizing them and putting them in a book. I used to tease Marshall that he's the only friend I have that has an index to his life.
Well, you know, when you're saying pull stories out of Marshall, the times I've been around him, it hasn't been an issue of pulling stories out of him. It's just been a matter of pulling yourself away, because at some point you have to leave. It's like he keeps talking and has all these amazing stories, it seems like. But the kinds of things that he has done, yes, in which that he has been a hypnotist, and he, of course, was a trade show magician, and then was Wizzo the Wizard on the Bozo show, and, of course, had sold these kits internationally and everything. So let me go back, I guess, to earlier in his life, that he was a stage hypnotist, I understand. And during the war, he was in the service, World War II, was it?
Yeah, I mean, yeah, he started his career doing traditional magic like most of us started. Just kind of chronologically, when he was 16 years old, he went to a famous amusement park in Chicago called Riverview. It's been gone a long time, but it was a real old school kind of amusement park. I've not personally been to Coney Island, but I imagine it's a similar sort of place. And at the time, Riverview had a proper sideshow, and Marshall wanted to be the magician in the sideshow, and he always likes to say that his life has been a series of lucky coincidences, but he approached the sideshow barker at the time when apparently there had been a falling out with the magician, and they had an opening. And so they asked Marshall how old he was, and he said, he lied and said he was 18 when he was in fact 16, and they hired him. And so he started performing magic on the sideshow, and he did a lot of performances. And then the sideshow barker, I can't remember if he fell ill or quit, but for some reason wasn't available. And so they literally pushed Marshall out onto the platform. Well, fortunately, Marshall had been studying that barker, sort of understood what needed to be done, and jumped right in and did it. And ultimately became the sideshow barker, and I'm going to guess one of the youngest sideshow barkers anywhere, and became quite skilled at it. So that's sort of where it started his career.
You know, I was visiting with Marshall in his home a few years back, and had recorded him doing his sideshow talker, and so just so that way everybody at least gets to hear a little bit of what that would have been like back then, let me play just about a minute or so that he had given me of him introducing some of the acts in the sideshow. So let me turn it over to Marshall Bodine as the sideshow talker.
Are you ready? Should we start with the monkey girl?
Yeah.
The monkey,
okay. Yeah.
You're going to see Priscilla, the monkey girl, with long black shaggy hair just like a monkey, two rows of teeth in the upper jaw like the anthropoid ape, pouches in the side of her mouth where she can store food for days at a time if necessary. She's married to Emmett the alligator skin man, covered from the top of his head to the toes of his feet, with rough, tough, corrugated hide laid out in checks and squares like that of a crocodile. His skin is so rough and tough you couldn't penetrate it with the sharpest knife, sheds his skin twice a year, like the crocodile in hot days keeps his body moist in cold water. You'll see the rubber skin man. You'll watch him stretch his skin 14 inches away from his body, let it snap back like an elastic rubber band. Twist and turn himself into more shapes than a pretzel. At times, he will amaze you. Then he'll make his stomach disappear so completely, place a football in the cavity, button up his shirt, you can't tell the football's there. You're going to see the Hindu faker, the anatomical wonder, the man with the disappearing stomach. You'll watch him stretch his skin 14 inches away from his body, let it snap back like an elastic rubber band, twist and turn himself into more shapes than a pretzel, at times he will amaze you. Did I do the sword swallower, the man that swallows swords, sabers, keyholes, swallows, wrecking fires, dope bogers, bayonets, and lighted neon tubes? You'll see the three-legged man with 13 toes. You'll watch him kick a football with his third leg. You'll see the armless wonder does everything with his feet. He'll operate a typewriter, paint with oil colors, thread a needle and sew, shuffle and deal a deck of playing cards. But when you see him take a cigarette paper in one foot, sack of tobacco in the other, roll a perfect cigarette with his feet, if your hands don't burn with applause, there's something radically wrong. The average man can't roll a cigarette with his hands. Here's a guy that does it with his feet. And it goes on and on.
All right, that was pretty interesting and pretty funny, but you know, I've got
amazing.
He is. I got one more short one about him introducing the fat man. So take a listen to this.
You see Tiny Carter, the world's fattest man, 679 pounds. Takes six girls to hug him and a boxcar to lug him. So girls, if you're looking for a husband, there's a big fat chance for you there. He'll keep you warm in the winter and shady in the summer.
Yeah, It's amazing that he still remembers it and can do it as if he's right back at Riverview.
Right, after all those years. And Riverview actually, I guess, closed. You said, of course, it was like Coney Island. Was it? Did you ever get to go to it as a child?
You know, I went once when I was very young with my parents, and I only have the very vaguest recollection of it. But I've seen lots of pictures and footage. It's a legendary place in Chicago, and so it's pretty easy to see pictures and film of Riverview.
Mm-hmm.
Much harder, though, to find pictures and film of the sideshow. So I haven't seen that, but I've gotten a pretty good description from Marshall over the years of the different acts.
Right. It was kind of funny about the when he was working then again at Riverview with an alligator wrestler, a lady. Tell that story.
Oh, sure. Yeah, there's some great stories about the days. I mean, you know, that was a side of show business, of course, that most of us have never seen. But Marshall was doing some road gigs, and he agreed to take one of the other acts from the sideshow, a female alligator wrestler, with him. And so they put the alligator in the trunk, and Marshall always drove nice cars. That was just one of his things. And so he had a beautiful new convertible. And so they put the alligator in the trunk of the car. And
it seemed like, to me, as I recall, I think when he was telling me this, and correct me if I'm wrong over there, that I think that it was the end of the season, and they were going to take this alligator back to an alligator farm or something. That's why they had the alligator to begin with.
That could be right. I don't remember that detail, but you could be right. And so they're driving down the road, heading wherever they're heading, and they hear this tearing sound, and Marshall looks over his shoulder, and he sees the jaws of the alligator kind of coming up out of the space between where the trunk and the roof come together. You know, there must have been a space there that the alligator could force himself through. So he heard this tearing of cloth, and he looks and he sees this alligator. So he kind of shouts to the trainer, who immediately leans over the back seat and starts punching the alligator in the nose to get him to go back down.
Right.
So the alligator does sort of retreat, and they pull into the next gas station, and this is in the days, of course, of full service.
Yeah.
The alligator wrestler goes around, opens the trunk, and starts taping the snout of the alligator with duct tape or something. At just about this time, the pump jockey comes walking over, sees this going on, literally drops the nozzle of the gas pump, and goes running off screaming, "There's a prehistorical monster in the trunk of that car."
That's a great story. Great one. And so after that closed, or he went then into the service, was he with the USO actually, or what did he do?
Well, he quickly concluded that being a soldier wasn't for him. and so he managed to get himself involved in USO. I don't think it was called USO at the time, but it was effectively the same thing. And so he ended up traveling around the country doing magic shows. He did a lot of different kinds of things. In fact, he liked to brag that he got the Army to buy him a lot of his props. And so Abbott's was a customer at the time, and he was buying props from Abbott's. And he did magic shows. He did hypnosis shows. He had an electric chair, which still exists, and it's owned by Don Theobald now. And he did escapes. He did upside-down straitjacket escape on several occasions.
Now, on those shows, were those actually just for the GIs or for their families, or what kind of audiences did he
have? He did a little bit of everything and found himself more often than not being tapped by officers to entertain at their events. So he did a little bit of everything. He did some big shows for lots of servicemen. I think a couple of his escapes were in those sorts of settings. He did the hypnosis shows for servicemen. But then he also did close-up magic at cocktail parties for top brass, and he met some of the top brass at the time doing those close-up engagements.
Hmm. And so, again, from moving on to that, then he came back into the U.S., I guess out of the service,
right.
And is that about the time he started doing some trade shows?
No, first he worked nightclubs. So about the time he came out of the service, there were high-end nightclubs in Chicago, literally all over town, and they were, from the pictures I've seen, they looked like, you know, the kind of showrooms you would have seen in Vegas at the time, you know, really elaborate showrooms with, some of them were supper clubs, some of them were you know, drinking establishments, but they'd have a full stage and lighting and an orchestra. And he did some magic in those venues, but mostly he did his stage hypnosis show.
Hmm. And I guess they had other variety acts as well as bands and whatnot there in the show. He just added to the variety.
That's right. Although most of the bills I've seen, he was the headliner, and was the, according to Marshall, that was the big draw. Because stage hypnosis, you know, people bring in their friends. If they've been and they've seen the show and they like it, then they bring their friends in because they want to see their friends be hypnotized and do the things that happen in a stage hypnosis show. And so as a result, Marshall's show ended up being the draw for a lot of these clubs.
Yeah, I saw some of the pictures where he would hypnotize people so they'd be stiff as a board and he could stand on them or something like that.
Exactly. In fact, Jay Marshall did an article for a glossy magazine in Chicago. I don't recall the name of the magazine. And he reviewed Marshall's performance. As the article was called Chicago, the Magic City, and it talked about some of the magic happening around Chicago. And he reviewed Marshall's show. And I've heard Jay say that Marshall had one of the best stage hypnosis shows he's ever seen.
Wow. And he's seen a lot, I'm sure.
Yes.
And so, obviously, that kind of started drying up as far as after vaudeville and then after the nightclubs started drying up. There got to be, fewer and fewer venues where he could perform.
And Marshall was very good at seeing where things were going. And so he talks about watching the news one morning. And by the way, it's probably worth mentioning these nightclubs were, for the most part, owned by, let's just say, the organized crime families. And, you know, so things would happen from time to time. And Marshall was watching the news one morning and saw that the nightclub in which he was working had gone up in flames, as he puts it, because they needed the insurance money. and he turned to his wife at the time and said, "Well, I guess I'm out of work." So he then pivoted from working in those nightclubs to working behind the bar. And, you know, bar magic in Chicago was fairly new at the time, but Marshall started to do that. He was really one of the early magic bartenders. And so he worked in a number of bars in places like suburbs of Chicago, sort of inventing that area of magic.
It is kind of interesting because I know that it proliferated for a while with, what was that, the New York Lounge and trying to think of some of the other ones that I had heard of. I hadn't visited, but I had read about. Julian's,
absolutely. In the time period where Marshall was working, I mean, Julian's was around. The New York Lounge wasn't around yet, but Johnny Paul had a club. Senator Crandall had a club. And these were sort of the big names. Bert Allerton, these were the big names in Chicago bar magic. And Marshall was working with these guys. He spent a lot of time behind the bar with Senator Crandall and really learned his trade doing close-up magic in these bars. He owned a bar for a short time himself. He bought it and I think concluded that running the business of the bar wasn't for him, although over his life he ended up buying and running a number of restaurants and bars.
I can only imagine what that must have been like, you know, Senator Crandall and Marshall Brodeen behind the bar. Wow. You know, I guess it's kind of like Doc Eason and Bob Sheets being behind the bar.
I think so. I regret not having been around to see that. He tells one great story of a couple coming in and Senator Crandall approaching the couple, and apparently they were fighting or there was something going on, and he approached to do some magic, and they turned and very, very brusquely said, "Get away from the table, magician." So Senator Crandall quietly walked over to the bar, tapped Marshall on the shoulder, said, "That couple over there, they asked to see you."
Just setting him up, yeah.
Yeah, oh yeah.
That's great. Well, during that time when he was working over there, I believe that there have been some other really good stories. Tell that one about where the guy wanted his girlfriend to know how the trick was done.
Oh, sure. Yeah. So the guy's name, he was a mobster, and his name was Gimpy. And he came into the bar one night and was having drinks with a young woman, and Marshall came over to show them magic, and Gimpy was not interested in watching the magic, and Marshall believes it's because he couldn't figure out the tricks were done, and he was insecure about that, and so he wouldn't watch. So Marshall was doing the magic for Gimpy's girlfriend, and that was going fine. And at one point, Marshall did the vanishing birdcage behind the bar. So he did the vanishing birdcage, and she was delighted and clapping and excited, and turned to Gimpy and said, "What happened to the cage?" And he wasn't watching. Well, how would I know? It's a trick. I don't know how it was done. And so he turned to Marshall and he said, "Where'd the cage go?" And Marshall said, "Oh, it's magic." And at that point, Gimpy reached into his jacket, pulled out a revolver, put it to Marshall's forehead, pulled the hammer back, and said, "Where's the effing cage?" And Marshall said, "It came out so quickly that it was almost magical." So that was probably the one and only time Marshall exposed a trick, but it seemed like a pretty good trade-off to me.
A good trade-off, right. So he could live to do another trick at another time.
Yeah. Then, of course, the postscript to that story, Scott, is that about 10 days later, Marshall was told by a colleague that Gimpy was found on a curb near the near that bar with about 21 slugs in his body.
Hmm. Died of lead poisoning.
That's what they say. Exactly.
Well, yeah. Must have been some very unique times.
You hear these stories long enough from Marshall, and they stop sounding strange.
That I can believe. That's true. The more you hear one or two, and you think, well, that's kind of an unusual. Well, not just kind of. That's a very unusual story. But he's got so many of those stories, just like those two you just shared there.
He does. I mean, it's for no other reason. I mean, the book is a great read because John has captured so many of those stories in the book.
Right. Whenever I read that, I could just hear his voice because it's almost word for word, that he had the way he's told the story so many times and they're so perfectly honed, without all the extraneous little side trips, but it's very, very, very good, very well written and good stories. So he was working then kind of in the mobs areas, I guess, in the nightclubs and all that, and that started to kind of go by the wayside, and then he was doing the bartending for a while, and then finally decided, I guess, he was going to own a bar, and that didn't work out. So what happened after that?
Well, it's somewhere along the line, somebody saw him at the bar and thought that maybe he could come and do something at a trade show. And so Marshall really was one of the early pioneers of doing magic at trade shows. One of the things about Marshall is he only saw opportunities. So if somebody came to him and offered him something like that, he was always willing to give it a try and see if it would work. And of course, because he was the kind of person he always made it work. So he started doing trade shows really before many other people. He remembers Eddie Tulloch being one of his contemporaries, but otherwise, he was in there pretty early.
It would have been what? Do you think the late 50s? Early 60s?
Probably late 50s or into the 60s. He was doing trade shows through the 60s and into the 70s.
Mm-hmm.
And he ended up being a very busy trade show performer. He did lots of trade shows. I think one of the strengths Marshall has is he's very good at working, kind of putting himself behind the message. I mean, he's not, him, Scott, he's not an egotistical man at all.
Right.
And I think in those settings, he was very comfortable in using magic to tell a story, but not forcing the magic into the foreground and not putting himself ahead of the message.
I think that's what made him successful early on, because he did recognize that difference. He wasn't there to do magic. He realized that he was there to sell the product and the service and the company and not himself.
Yeah, exactly. And that's sort of been the way he's done all of the performing in his life, whether it's magic, hypnosis. His personality and style is a very comfortable, relaxed style where he lets the whatever it is that he's doing speak for itself. And so as a result, he ended up becoming a very, very popular trade show performer. He also did, in that same period, industrial films. I saw one great film where he was interacting with the Pillsbury Doughboy before the Pillsbury Doughboy had gone national. It was an early kind of test of that character.
That's kind of funny. So, well, I know that Chicago and New York were two major hubs where there were big ad agencies, with Leo Burnett and J. Walter Thompson and all the rest of those. So he probably worked with some of those ad agencies to those commercials.
Yeah, I think that's that's right. I think he worked with a trade show agency that had found him initially, and I think that's where he got a lot of his work. But, you know, as I say, he became very popular and very successful in that field, so much so that, you know, over the years, he ended up giving a lot of work that he couldn't do because he was so in demand to other performers. And if you talk to people like Johnny Thompson or George Johnstone, they will tell you that they owe a big part of their early livelihood to Marshall Brodeen because he was keeping them busy as well.
Yeah, when we had Marshall as one of the honored guests at the TAOM this last year in Dallas, that Johnny Thompson and others just kind of, you know, took the stage and were, you know, giving homage to Marshall and saying how much they appreciate what all that they have done. And I think a lot of people probably were surprised about how many lives that he's touched who have gone on to greatness.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you know, the thing about Marshall, for those who are lucky enough to have known him, is that he's an extremely generous man. He's always thinking about how he can help his friends and what would be good for his friends. He would never let a gig that he couldn't do get away. He'd make absolutely sure that one of his friends got that gig. I mean, I know, you know, lots of stories of friends that were in various sorts of financial trouble, and Marshall bailed them out one way or another, always did it in a quiet, understated, unassuming way. And then once he had the access to television through the Bozo show, he made sure endlessly that his friends had opportunities to perform on the show, including some that I think most people would admit probably weren't ready for the opportunity. But to Marshall, it was more important to help his friends.
Well, I mentioned the ad agencies a little bit earlier because I was wondering perhaps he may, as he started to do some commercials, made some contacts and felt comfortable working in front of the camera. Of course, felt comfortable working in front of people, not only from the shows but also from trade shows, and knew how to pitch a product,
right,
and everything, so he could,
right,
then put something together to make the commercials that he did. Now, was it the TV Magic Cards that was his first commercial success?
He had, basically, yes. He had done a couple of local commercials as a spokesperson. You know, he was hired, I think, if I remember correctly, he did a carpet ad or something like that. But he'd done a couple of those things. But what really sparked his interest in the TV Magic Cards was when he was doing the carnivals and sideshows, he saw the pitchmen that show up on the carnival midways. And in fact, he saw a guy named Jimmy Dixon do a Svengali pitch, and many of us have seen really good Svengali pitches. And so Marshall was watching this guy day in and day out, and he said every time he was good at gathering a crowd, and then once he gathered a crowd, he'd always sell, you know, 15, 20 of these decks. And Marshall started to think, you know, his audience is by definition going to be limited. What if he did that exact same presentation, but did it on television? And that was really the genesis of TV Magic Cards. Marshall developed this Svengali pitch, and the rest is history.
Wow. And how successful, as far as numbers? Have you heard him tell you any numbers, how many have sold?
They started slowly, because Marshall initially bought airtime to do this from local television stations. And of course, buying airtime even then was expensive, so he had to start slowly. But once they went with a bigger ad campaign and they went national, the TV Magic Cards and then later the sets were very successful. And I think he has said to me that over the course of TV Magic Cards, they've sold over 11 million decks.
Wow, that is pretty successful sales, I should
say.
And essentially, amazing. The TV Magic Cards were just that—just a Svengali deck.
That's exactly what they were. And over time, they developed some other products. They had a stripper deck that they had a different name for. I can't remember now what it was, maybe the TV Miracle deck or something like that. And then, of course, the Magic Sets, which had their own pitches. But effectively, he was just doing a midway pitch, but doing it on television. And if you watch the pitch, it's pretty clever in that it very much focused on making it clear that a layman could do the magic, and very important, well-constructed messages that cause people to say, hey, I could do that.
I wonder how I came up with the idea of calling them TV Magic Cards in order to get away from the Svengali name.
Yeah, I think he said it wasn't there wasn't anything particularly clever about it. They were just, you know, magic cards, and he was doing them on TV. I think I really think it was as simple as that.
Simple as that. Interesting.
Yeah.
And so then he started with the magic kits and everything like that, and then somewhere along the line, then he got affiliated with the Bozo Magic Show.
Yeah, so the Bozo Show, he started, first of all, for your listeners, I mean, Chicagoans will know this, but people around the rest of the country, it's hard to convey what a phenomenon that show was in Chicago. I think most people would say it was certainly the longest running and by any measure the most successful children's television show in the history of television, even to this date. It ran on WGN television for 40 years. It was a daily show that, for the first 25 years or so, it aired at lunchtime. And so kids would come home from school to have their lunch, and they would watch as much of the show as they could before they had to go back to school. And it was a combination of skits by the cast of clowns, games, cartoons, and the characters on the show became such celebrities in Chicago that they surpassed really almost anyone else. And the statistic, or the kind of factoid I like to share, is we had a big festival in Chicago every year called Chicago Fest. It was down on the lakefront and very, very popular. And at night they would have headline entertainment, and these would be people like the Blues Brothers and one year Frank Sinatra. And Frank Sinatra drew 800,000 people to the lakefront for his concert. That same year, the Bozo Circus cast did a live performance at lunchtime and drew over 1 million people.
Wow. A bunch of clowns brought in more people than Frank Sinatra.
Absolutely. I mean, they really were a phenomenon in Chicago. And I think you and I have talked about this before, but, you know, the legend, which I can tell you wasn't a legend, is that when a woman would find out she was expecting a child, she would write into WGN for tickets to the Bozo Show because it was filmed live. And with the hope that about the time the child reached the age of 10 or 11, she'd actually get those tickets.
It would take that long.
It would take that long. They finally cut the waiting list off when the backlog was 14 years.
Well, that's pretty good to think you would have that kind of longevity if you worked on that show, to think, okay, well, I've got a job at least for another 16 years because I got people coming in. But WGN,
yeah, exactly.
Of course, it was a mega station, and I lived and was brought up in Southern Illinois and used to be able to see that as a child, and I've talked with others around the country, and they said that they picked it up also. Because, Mac, a lot of people don't know this, or maybe in other countries who are listening to this wouldn't know it, but recognize that there were just three stations or three networks of the ABC, CBS, and NBC.
Right.
And really, WGN, in a way, kind of got in with its own station. You know, it didn't have you know, programs that it would develop just for itself, except for the Bozo Show, and I guess, as I recall.
That's exactly right. Yeah, the Bozo Show and the Chicago Cubs were the big things for WGN, and mm-hmm. The Bozo Show was just wildly successful, and that's the show that Marshall started with. When the show first came on, they early on decided they were going to have variety acts come on, circus acts, magicians, jugglers, that sort of thing. And Marshall was one of the very first to go on the show as a magician. And when he first went on, he went on as Marshall Brodeen. He wore white tie and tails, a very traditional sort of look. But he succeeded because rather than just getting in front of the camera and doing his act, he would interact with the clowns and would bring them into the magic he was doing. And the producer very quickly recognized that it just made it better for television. And so they started bringing Marshall back regularly. He was very popular with the Bozo Circus Show. And along the way, he showed up one day and he had a costume from a trade show that he'd worked. It was a Sultan's costume. And he said to the producer, "What would you think about me wearing this on the air?" And the producer said, "Let's give it a try." And then Marshall started acting a little bit crazy in the costume. And slowly, over the period of a couple of weeks, the character of Wizzo the Wacky Wizard was born.
And he had that funny phrase of "duty, duty."
it became such a catchphrase that even today, when people see him in public, they say it. And he wore a piece of costume jewelry around his neck, kind of a gaudy piece of costume jewelry, and that was the Stone of Zanzibar. And so rather than waving a magic wand, he would touch things with the stone. And one of the things that kids that didn't appreciate was that there was a lot of very adult humor going on the Bozo Show, which made it very popular with adults. And so there was always sort of two levels of comedy going on, the slapstick that the kids love, and some pretty risque and off-color humor that the clowns were doing for the entertainment of the adults.
Yeah, so when you're saying the kids didn't appreciate it, you mean that they didn't understand it. I mean, they had it from
right.
a different level, that they were laughing at something that the adults were laughing at on a different...
Exactly right. There was a lot of double entendre, and, you know, Marshall actually pointed out to me, I didn't pick this up until he did, that Bozo, played by a great, great character actor named Bob Bell, always did the sex jokes, and Cookie... played by another great character actor by the name of Roy Brown, always did the drinking jokes. And when you go back and watch it as an adult, it's actually very funny, because there's a lot of humor going on that as a kid you never would have picked up.
Hmm. Now, did he actually play those commercials where he was selling TV magic cards? I mean, was that a sponsor of the Bozo Show?
No, I don't think they ever sponsored the Bozo Show, but well, a funny story is, you know, the FCC has a rule that if you are a character on a show like that, you cannot promote a product that you're selling. It's a conflict of interest. And so, but the FCC never figured out that Marshall Brodeen and Wizzo were the same guy. So when they would give away prizes during the games, Marshall would often give away TV magic cards or TV magic sets and talk about what great products they were, and get free advertising for his products without ever really being called on that.
That's pretty funny. So he was able still to sell some things, and people didn't know it was him. That's except the adults, I guess. That's funny. That's funny. So he stayed on with the show. Do you know about how long, how many years that he was with Bozo?
Yeah, it was about 27 years. And he just, a number of things were happening then. The show went to a different format. It went from noontime to the morning because the, you know, demographics were changing. Kids weren't coming home for lunch anymore because of dual income households. Mm-hmm. And so they went to a morning show, and they went from live to tape, and other things were changing. And Marshall just decided that, you know, it was a good run. He'd had a lot of fun, but he was sort of ready to stop doing that. So he retired from the show, and Roy Brown retired about the same time. And he never went back until the very, very last show. The WGN did a two-hour network special that actually aired all over the country, and Marshall agreed to go back and do that. In fact, that was so popular that that night David Letterman did the top 10 list on the retirement of Bozo the Clown.
And as I recall, that there were a lot of other special guests, I guess, who came in for that final taping, and you got to be there even.
I mean, it was the golden ticket to the chocolate factory for me, because Marshall had called me and said, you know, we're brainstorming ideas that we can do on this final show. And so he and I sat at our kitchen, at my kitchen table, and sketched out some ideas. And I suggested the idea of the backstage illusion, which, you know, you can have a lot of fun with on television. And I was suggesting it in that the clowns and the characters would do it, and I would simply provide the prop. And so we're chatting about it, and he said, I love that idea. I'm gonna talk to Al Hall, the producer, about it. And about 2 days later, my phone rang, and Marshall's on the phone. He says, well, it's all set. You're going to do the backstage on the show. And I literally was stunned, because it wasn't at all what I expected. So Sue and I were lucky enough to be there at the very end of the Bozo Show and perform on the show. It was great fun.
Well, because over the years, they had a lot of magicians who were coming in. And I think Johnny Thompson even was on there a time or two.
Yeah, well, even David Copperfield. You're right. The list of magicians that appeared on the show was amazing. And in fact, there's a great story, which David may hate me for telling, but he had done a show in Chicago called The Magic Man.
Mm-hmm.
And he went on the Bozo Show promote The Magic Man. And nobody could remember for sure whether David had been there. And so somehow Marshall had talked to Bill Smith and said, when you see David, ask him if he'd ever appeared on the Bozo Show. And the message came back through Bill. David said yes. He was on the Bozo Show in whatever month and whatever year that he was there. And I left my balls in bucket number 6.
So that's another one of those things that kids can appreciate and adults at a different level.
Exactly. We'll leave it to your listeners to figure that one out.
That's right. If you've seen the Bozo Show, you know exactly what he's talking about.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay. And so that kind of ended that part of his life, but he continued to do a lot of other corporate shows and everything. And there was one show also we had talked about before where he had entertained for one of the mob bosses, I guess. So
that was earlier on, but I know you're you know, the entertainment scene in Chicago, as it was in a lot of cities in the day, was very much controlled by the mob. And so Marshall ended up doing lots of shows, for mob people. He always described them as very nice people, so long as he didn't get on their bad side. And the story I think you're thinking about is that he did a show at Jackie Cerrone's house, and anybody that follows the mob knows that he was one of the most vicious gangsters in Chicago. So Marshall did the show. The show went fine, and apparently, toward the end, Jackie gave Marshall a drink, and it turned out to be a cognac. And Marshall said, "This is really delicious." And so Jackie motioned to one of his lieutenants and said, "Get the magician a bottle of this." And so the lieutenant takes off and comes back, and it turns out to be a bottle of Louis XIII cognac, which, as you know, Scott, comes in a Bacharach crystal bottle, and I think even today sells for $3,000 or $4,000.
Right.
And so he presented this in a beautiful case to Marshall. The lieutenant did. By then, Jackie had left the room. And Marshall, being the inveterate collector, said, "Hey, do you think Jackie would sign this for me?" And the response came back, "Bodine, Jackie don't sign nothing." So
yeah.
Marshall still has that bottle. It's on display in his home. And a couple of Christmases ago, when we were there, he got it in his mind that he was going to open it, and we were all going to share it, because he said, the other thing that Cerrone said was, "Bodine, you share this with the one you love. You got it?" So he wanted to open the bottle, and I said to him, "You know what, Marshall, the story is better than the liquor ever will be." And so it's still sitting on display in his home.
Still sitting there. Yeah, I remember just an addendum to that. He was telling me whenever that he was going to be doing that show, they said, "Well, we'll have a driver to come and pick you up, because we don't want you to drive here, because the feds are watching the house, and they'll see your driver or your license plate, and they'll start following you or, you know, check you out."
Yeah, exactly. Exactly right.
Interesting. I'm sure there are just dozens more stories, you know, a lot like that then, too. So he, again, had continued to evolve. He always seems to be someone who recreated himself all the time.
Yeah, one of the amazing things about Marshall, and you're right, I mean, after he left the Bozo Show, he continued with the magic sets. He ended up going on Home Shopping Network, both individually and with Lance Burton, to sell magic sets, and that was really successful. And you're right, Scott, he continues to has always reinvented himself. One of the things I've come to learn about Marshall is, you know, he kind of has the classic entrepreneurial mindset. And by that I mean, you know, most people will see reasons not to do something, and he sees challenges as an opportunity. And so throughout his life, he's taken big risks, some of which have led to great success, some of which haven't. I mean, we haven't talked about the number of restaurants and bars that he owned that failed. But he always saw that as an opportunity. He always saw it as a chance to do something interesting and fun. Interestingly, he's not someone, in my estimation, who did anything he did in his life for money. That's not what motivated him. He did it because it would be fun or interesting or, and I really believe this to his core, would help one of his friends. And many of those things just paid off for him.
And he decided really never to move to Las Vegas or to have a show or anything like that, even though that was kind of the direction that those nightclubs were going. But he did some sort of a show that I guess kind of failed. Was that a television show, or World's Greatest Magic?
Well, he's had a number of failures over the years. He opened a nightclub in Chicago called Toto's, which had a magic circus theme, which ended up not being financially successful. He did a television show which starred Lance Burton that never made it to air, and it was a lot of Marshall's personal money was tied up in that. I've seen the footage of it. It was a great show, but there were technical problems, and the producers didn't do what they were supposed to do. But Marshall was willing to take the risk, invest the money, and it didn't come together.
Well, and I know, again, we have talked about some other ideas that he's even looked at. I think, tell about that story that just walking in the airport that time.
Oh, yeah. Well, this just reflects to me the way Marshall's mind works and how he was ahead of his time. If he'd stayed with the Magic Sets a little longer, he was telling me one day, we were talking about marketing and magic, and he said, you know, I've got this idea that I would build this big vending machine, and the vending machine would have magic tricks in it, like the TV magic cards, and at the top of the machine there would be a video, like a TV screen, with a continuous loop of demonstrations, and people could stand there and watch the demonstrations, and then if they liked what they saw, they'd put their money into the machine, push the A5, and the TV magic cards would drop out at the bottom. And you wouldn't need to pay a demonstrator, and you know the machine would not require any sort of labor or maintenance. It would just sit there and make money. And I remember thinking at the time, that's really an interesting idea. And about 3 years later, I was walking through the airport, Bush Airport here in Houston, and walked past a machine that Best Buy had that worked exactly that way. It had the TV screen at the top, and it had, you know, headphones and iPods and whatever else they had for sale in there. And right next to it was a similar machine for ladies' cosmetics. And I remember thinking, you know, Marshall is just ahead of his time again.
Right. Yeah, something he's always thinking of, the next opportunity, I guess. So he's been very successful throughout all of his career. Did he have any other ideas or something he was planning on doing? Again, it seems over the past few years he has fallen into dementia and sadly Alzheimer's. Any other ideas or directions he was planning on going?
Well, I think I think he was winding down on the Magic Sets, and he was looking for someone to sort of take on that business from him, and I think the timing just got the best of him there. But, you know, he was also very actively performing until his illness set in. In fact, he and I did lots of live shows around Chicago. And, you know, and at that point in Marshall's life, he wasn't doing it for the money, so we did a lot of, together, did a lot of charity events. We had a theater show called Marshall Brodeen and Friends. It was very easy. Marshall could pick up the phone and within 10 minutes put together a spectacular show of talent because no one would say no to him. And so he would just decide, we're going to do this charity event, and he'd start calling around, and 15 minutes later we had a show. And so he and I would MC the show, and we would be surrounded by just great talent, all of whom were just happy to help their friend.
And over the years, you said you raised how much money over there?
I don't know that I've ever added it up, but we did one show in the Chicago area that was focused on raising money for a group that provides wheelchairs in third world countries. And we raised just shy of $50,000 doing two shows in support of that charity. And then another show that I'm personally very proud of is all due to Marshall, and that is to support food pantries. And it was in honor of a young lady, daughter of a magician in Chicago, who was killed by a drunk driver. And the first year they did the show, it was moderately successful. Then they called Marshall and said, we're doing this thing and we'd really like you to help. And Marshall called me up and said, we're doing a benefit, and we did. And this past year was the 10th anniversary of that event, and it's still going strong. And even though Marshall doesn't perform anymore, he still comes every year, and he's at the meet and greet, and he's just there shaking hands, signing autographs, and meeting people, and continuing to show his support for it.
Now, he has a son who does magic also, I understand. Is he
Is
he looking at maybe taking over that legacy?
He's certainly wanting to continue to perform. His son, it's Marshall Jr., has a full-time career with the United Airlines, but he performs part-time, and I don't know if he envisions himself taking on the magic sets. He hasn't said to me, but he's an active performer and loves magic, and so at least that part of the legacy continues.
And he has how many children altogether?
He has one other son and two daughters. His son is a chef, no involvement in magic, but lives in Indiana with his family and doing very well. And then he has a daughter who lives up in the north suburbs of Chicago, and another daughter who is in Florida.
And his wife, Mary, successful with a publishing career?
Absolutely. Mary is a very successful and very talented author. In fact, that's how she and Marshall met. She was writing for Chicago Tribune, and she did a very lengthy article on another magician, Terry Evanswood. And during her interviews with Terry, Terry mentioned that she should talk to Marshall because Marshall knows Terry and might say some things about Terry and his, you know, his magic. So Mary contacted Marshall and arranged an interview. Marshall, having a good eye, recognized a good thing when he saw one and invited Mary on a date. And the rest is history.
That's great. Wonderful.
Yeah, and of course, as you know, Scott, because you know Mary, she is an amazing woman. And now, as Marshall is facing these health challenges, has just stepped up in ways that I can't even comprehend, and really a saint in taking care of Marshall and being his friend and his companion. And it's really terrific.
That's always difficult in a family, but it's great to have someone who loves you so much that can take care of you in that time of need in particular. Well, any other comments, stories, or something that you want to leave as we start to wrap this up?
You know, I mean, there are so many stories, and so I guess the first thing I would say is for anybody listening, if you don't have the book, a lot of the magic shops have it, and I can't encourage you more strongly to pick it up. The book is filled with pictures, which is just great. It's a really good read. I think Marshall is an inspiration to magicians in so many ways. One, that he really is a general practitioner, and you know, the people that I looked up to in magic, people like Jay Marshall, Carol Fox, they would all have said the same thing, which is, you know, you should be able to do a little bit of everything to be successful in magic. I think Marshall, you know, taught me to see opportunities rather than challenges. And, you know, I think part of the reason he's been so successful is that attitude. Francis Marshall used to say that Marshall Burdine is the most upbeat person she knows. And I think that really made him what he is. And lastly, and the thing I hope I try to emulate every day, is Marshall's a good friend, you know, to everybody who he comes into contact with. He's a very giving person, and I think that came back to him in ways that he never really appreciated. He always described himself as a very lucky person. I don't think it's luck. I think it's what he put out there.
Yep, it has come back. What he has sown, he has certainly reaped in spades, so to speak.
That's what I believe.
Yeah,
yep.
That's true. Well, hopefully the book will be available through Amazon, I think, if people do an Amazon.com search or something. I believe that
yep.
They can locate that book. But I agree heartily that is a very good book and well worth reading, and just a lot of fun to read all those stories and hear about someone's magical life. That's great.
I agree.
Thank you very much, Mark. You've been very nice and helpful in trying to let us know more about the magical life of Marshall Brodine.
It's been a pleasure, Scott. I enjoyed it.
Well, thank you. And that was Mark Holstein. And for The Magic Word, this is Scotty out.